that are left out. The problems and issues of Muslim states and Muslim nations. There are lots of, you know, multitudes of problems from Kashmir as far as Libya, where you see problems everywhere. So hopefully, on the back of Muslim unity, all of these issues could be addressed. Okay, that was the second issue, the unity week. Now, as for the 13th of Aban, or November 3rd, interestingly, 13th of Aban, that's the day of fighting the global arrogance, is concurrent with the birth anniversary of Prophet of Islam. And we have this Quranic verse that Muhammad is the messenger of God, and whoever is with him, they are kind among themselves, and they are harsh against their enemies. This is what you see, this great move by our views. And the 13th of Aban, or November 3rd, is the day, the manifestation of the fight against global arrogance by the Iranians. It was not only an issue of an embassy thing, it was a great thing that was done, a symbolic move in the fight against global arrogance. Now, the U.S. establishment is an arrogant one, is an imperialist one, and it's a source of lots of treachery, lots of evil. That's what it's warmongering, it's terrorists, it nurtures terrorists, it's interventionist, it's corrupt, it's seeking monopoly. This is, when you talk about global arrogance and imperialism, this all these ills you could envision within it. So, battling such a thing, such a phenomenon, is exactly tantamount to being wise. Well, some people say, no, this is unwise, this is not sagacious. That's not true. This is exactly the wise thing to do. I mean, surrendering to and bowing down to is actually unwise. And we never initiated things. I mean, the Quran also mentions the same thing exactly, and it says they started it after the Islamic Revolution in Iran. We didn't attack the embassy. I mean, the U.S. embassy was there when the revolution happened. They were doing their job, but they started making moves against the Islamic establishment, both inside the U.S. They had resolution after resolution, speech after speech in Congress. They took measures against the Islamic Republic. That was a nascent establishment. They made decisions against this nascent establishment. They had this terrorist groups launched against us. They had coup d'etat mongers created against us. Inside the U.S. embassy, that was said, you know, the right name was chosen for that, the den of espionage. They were embarking on great spying activity. They started all of this. And so when they started this, it was then our students' move that they stormed the embassy, and that was in defense. That was the timely one. That was the right one. It was based on wisdom. Let me also mention this fact that some people would, they have their assumption of the U.S. Establishment is a wrong one. They believe that if such a government surrenders to that regime, then they will benefit from that. No, that's not the case. I mean, these people that you see in the world, that these governments that they have to do with the U.S. and that they are a little better off, and that's because they did not surrender. I mean, the more relations you have and the more interference the U.S. has in that country, they will be harmed. But those who have surrendered to the Americans, they have accepted and adopted U.S. policies, and they accept the humiliation of being under the U.S. influence and thumb, they have been harmed. Like Camp David is an instance. We have also an instance of the Pahlavi regime in our own country. The country was really moving backward by surrendering to American policies. First day after day, those regimes will become more dependent. Now, as for the U.S., our policy is a well-calculated one. And this policy does not change with people being replaced, taking power. Well, today we have the elections in the U.S. Now, some people is talking about what's going to happen if this person or that person comes to power. Well, things may happen. Well, yes, but it has nothing to do with us. I mean, it will not impact our policies. We have our own clear-cut and well-calculated policies, and it doesn't make any difference who takes office. I mean, but we need to look at their own situation. You see, you know, it's really interesting to watch the president, the incumbent president, and he is going to hold the election. He's in charge of holding the election, actually, and he's saying that this is the most fraudulent election in the U.S. history. Who's saying this? The very same president who is in charge, and he's actually holding the elections. And he's saying that you see the greatest extent of fraud in U.S. history. And then his rival says in return that Trump wants to embark on extensive fraud. This is U.S. democracy. That's the style of U.S. democracy. I mean, they themselves, that's how they comment about their own elections. And this shows the ugly face of liberal democracy within American society. Now, regardless of who is going to be elected, this one or that one, could be voted for, it will be clear today. Now, one thing is certain, and that's the political, moral, and social decadence of the U.S., no matter who is elected. Well, the American regime is beset with political and civil decadence, and a moral one also. This is not an interpretation. This is not an interpretation. This is what they themselves are confessing. This is what they are uttering. These are their own speakers, their own writers and authors and spokespeople, their own think tanks inside America. These are the comments that they are making. In the past years, they have written a number of books, and they have sold out in the U.S. Some of those books, you know, they reveal some facts. One of those books that was translated into Farsi, I just read that one. It's replete with all signs of this decadence that I'm in. I mean, if you read that book, from the very beginning to the very end, it shows, the whole thing that it shows is the decadence of the U.S. establishment, I mean, the moves that the U.S. president has taken and his actions. This empire will not last long. I mean, when they come to this point, when politics of, when the regime reaches this point, they will not last so long. They're on their last legs. Of course, some of them will make the U.S. feel that destruction maybe sooner. Some of them later, but that's the fact. Well, their animosity against us is because that we do not accept and surrender to their, recognize their dominance, because we did not give up to them, because we did not accept their policies in the region, the policies toward Palestine. That's what we rejected, their brutal policies we did not accept. That's why they're antagonistic, and this will go on. This antagonism will persist, and the only way to remove this antagonism is that we do something to disappoint them. I mean, we should, the Iranian people, the government of Iran should do things in such a way, we should come to the point to disappoint the other side, and they should be discouraged from dealing with the blow. We need to strengthen ourselves. I've repeatedly told our people and also officials in the meetings that we have, working meetings or private meetings that I have had with the authorities, I have mentioned this point, that what's needed is that the real power, true power, is what we need to strengthen within ourselves. People should be stronger, then the enemy will be despaired. Of course, the people have pulled up great resistance, stiff resistance, really. We had the sanctions problems and its impacts and ramifications. The people have really withstood all these problems. People have been really resilient. And so in three areas, the officials need to make more moves and better moves in economy, security, and culture. In these three fields, we need to augment, the authorities need to augment their efforts and activity. Now, when it comes to economy, I mean, we should have the right look. That is that we shouldn't have our eyes cast upon outside everyone. It doesn't mean that we sever relations, no. When I say that you should find the cure and treatment inside, some people on social media start speaking about this and say that we should sever our relations with the outside world. No, that's not what I'm saying. We should have our relations ongoing, but what is that? We shouldn't seek the treatment and the cure from outside of our own society. We should find it inside the country. That's what we should try to do. And the main thing is to boost production that I've stressed on numerous occasions. We need to have this well-planned and well-organized drive in the field of economy. There are so many problems that we're facing these days. They have nothing to do with sanctions. They have to do with our own a lack of coordination and this high prices recently. No justification for that, the high prices. To a large extent, some of them cannot be justified. They need to be addressed. They have to be addressed, and the officials need to act in coordination. And you see that you have high prices. You have beef, and you have the price of chicken, tomatoes, all the way to diapers. You know, so high prices can be seen without any good reason for this. I mean, no justification for that. And you have all those goods and commodities out in the market on the shelves. Everything is available there. I mean, if the Ministry of the relevant ministries and government bodies, some other organizations who have to deal with these and customs and others, they need to join hands, they need to cooperate, and they need to tackle the problem. All of these could be addressed and controlled. So, on the back of a coordinated management and coordination among different government bodies, the problems could be addressed. Now, as for security, when we're talking about, of course, foreign security, the country needs to be equipped with defense capabilities. You see drones, fighter jets, and missiles. That's what we're engaged in. This brings you security. It causes the country not to be targeted by the enemy. The enemy will never feel like attacking or invading the country if you're strong. Well, you cannot address all the problems by making missiles. Some of the problems have nothing to do with missile building. But many of the problems have to do with these very same defensive equipment. As for internal domestic security, intelligence apparatus should be vigilant and careful about infiltration of the enemy and their penetration into different bodies. That's the main problem, that they should be careful about and cautious. So, culturally speaking, also cultural authorities need to make attempts, and they should be wise attempts. You know, sometimes we may do a lot of cultural work, but they should be smart. We got to know what to do in what area, which activity suits best in what environment. If we do act like that, then I would leave these three categories: economy, security, and culture. These are the basic fields on the back of vigilance, coordination, and cooperation. Hopefully, things would be addressed. Officials are working. They need to act more seriously. And the last point being regarding this war that's happening in our neighborhood, unfortunately, between two neighbors, Azerbaijan and Armenia. This is a bitter incident. I mean, it threatens regional security. It's not good for our country either. So, as soon as possible, it should come to an end. Of course, territories of Azerbaijan that have been occupied by Armenia, they need to be liberated. All those lands should go back and return to Azerbaijan Republic. That's the main condition. Well, that land belongs to Azerbaijan, the Republic of Azerbaijan, and to liberate those lands, Azerbaijan is entitled. They need, those lands need to go back to Azerbaijan. Of course, the Armenians who are residing in those territories, they need to be provided with security. International border should also be respected. I mean, the two sides should respect the borders of countries. No aggression should be made against them. So international frontiers should also be there. And terrorists should not be stationed near our borders, as we have in our reports. Of course, some people are denying this, but we have reports that are reliable that a number of terrorists from here and there have pitched in. If they are close to borders, if we feel threatened, we will act accordingly. Definitely will act decisively, so they shouldn't approach our borders. Hopefully, all Muslim nations and the nations in the region and human society, the entire human society, will get rid of all these problems and issues. And then, dear respected people of Iran, on the back of this auspicious birth occasion and the pure soul of the late Imam, the Imam Sadiq, and the pure soul of Prophet of Islam, hopefully we will be awaiting bright days in the near future. Hopefully this future is around the corner. And that's the end of this speech.
Dear listeners, what you heard was the live coverage of the speech delivered by the leader of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the occasion of the auspicious birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as well as the birth anniversary of Imam Jafar Sadiq, the 16th infallible heir of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him. Well, dear listeners, in this speech, the leader of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, first of all, slammed the French government's blasphemous action in the desecration of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Also, the leader of Islamic Revolution slammed certain Arab regimes for the humiliating act of normalizing ties with the Zionist regime. The leader said these Arab regimes trampled upon Palestinian nations' rights by normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. So the leader said plots by enemies require Muslims to forge unity more than ever. Also, the leader of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, slammed the United States as the main criminal in committing various crimes in the West Asia region. Also, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei again reiterated the importance of Islamic Unity Week for Muslims. The leader also denounced the Saudi regime for brutally killing innocent people of Yemen. And also the leader reiterated the importance of today, November 3rd, marking the day to fight the global arrogance in Iran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Iran's policy toward the United States is not going to change as the U.S. governments come and go. Dear listeners, I here, on behalf of all IRB English radio staff, congratulate all Muslims around the world on the auspicious birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and Imam Jafar Sadiq, peace be upon him. Please stay with IRB English radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. What you just heard was our special coverage. We now return to our normal course of programs. God debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. India is attempting to make the semi-autonomous Kashmir region a lot less autonomous. There has been a crackdown on this region since August of last year and now decade-old laws repealed. Those living in Indian-controlled Kashmir have protested and now another shutdown has been implemented by New Delhi on the region. Local residents are defiant about Indian measures, especially those allowing others to buy land in this region instead of just locals, as the previous law had allowed. I'd like to welcome my guests to this program, and hopefully we will have an interesting debate right after this package.
A shutdown is being observed in Indian-controlled Kashmir after New Delhi amended and repealed a series of decades-old land laws of Kashmir. The new reorganization law issued on October 26, 2020, opens up all of Jammu and Kashmir to every Indian citizen and removes every restriction that prevented large land holdings. Allows the Indian armed forces to take over land wherever they desire and gives sweeping powers to the government to take over any land and property for industrial use and bring in big businesses to set up their shops. The October 26, 2020 order repealed 13 state laws and amends 14 laws. Experts say this is to further the agenda behind the abrogation.
The aim is very much, yes, to disempower the Muslim majority of the state of J&K, and in fact, to erase them in history and in culture. I think that that is something that is not a big surprise. The question is how successful they're going to be at doing it, and it's something that only time will tell.
According to historic date check, these laws were introduced to empower the majority Muslims who were suffering immensely under the non-Muslim rulers. Not only this, but the rights to buy and sell land in Kashmir were also confined to the people of Kashmir. Experts say India's move in Kashmir since August 5, 2019 has further internationalized this conflict.
Kashmir is a small blip on the international scenario. But I think that it is gaining salience, and it is gaining an advantage. We are gaining an advantage out of it. Simply, and one of the biggest evidences of that is what happened with the Chinese so-called, but actual incursion into Jammu and Kashmir territory in Ladakh.
In response to the shutdown call by Pro-Freedom Camp of Kashmir, shops and businesses remained closed. Huge number of government forces were seen guarding the streets to avoid law and order problems. Almost seven decades ago, these laws were introduced to empower the Muslim majority of Kashmir. But today, when the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party is repealing and amending the same laws, the people of Kashmir are watching over helplessly. Experts say this move clearly depicts India's intentions in Kashmir. Shahana Butt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Out of London, Reza Kazim, Islamic Human Rights Commission, and out of Qom, Iran, Sarbaz Ruhollah Rezvi, peace and justice activist and researcher. Thank you both for being with us. Starting us off in London with Reza, why do you think that New Delhi has increased its pressure on this region since last year in the way it has?
I think we've seen a change in dynamics in the Indian politics, in particular with the rise of the BJP in the recent decades, and the kind of way direction the whole of India has actually gone in terms of Hindu supremacies, and how that is being manifested upon all sections of Indian society. And this old, very old area, which is occupied Kashmir, which is something that is something that has very much been part of the Hindu supremacist agenda in terms of trying to make sure that it becomes very much part and parcel. And what we're seeing is a settler colonial project being manifested, and India being seen very much and seeing itself in the light of a colonial power, and doing the things that a colonial power does. And that's what's being enacted within the case of Kashmir.
Well, Saibaz Ruhollah, your perspective on the overall goal of changing these various laws, particularly pertaining to this area?
It's quite clear that the Indian politicians in BJP, they have concluded that if they want to resolve, so-called from their perspective, resolve the issue of Kashmir, there is no other way except to change the demography of Kashmir. Because at the end, Jammu Kashmir is a Muslim majority state. Still, Jammu Kashmir was the only Muslim majority state of India. So because of this population of the Muslims over here and their take and their hold on the lands and their position over here, they were feeling that the issue of Kashmir is not going to be resolved as they wish. So that's why they start all these series of acts from August 2019 till today. In 2019, in August, we had the abrogation of Article 370, an article that was claimed to give Kashmir a limited autonomy. Actually, that even that limited autonomy was not implemented as it was supposed to be implemented based on the Constitution of India during all four decades. But that was abrogated. So there was an act of 35A under Article 370 of Indian Constitution that was actually giving three, four important points to the people of Kashmir. One, to define who is the resident, permanent resident of Kashmir, to define who can possess any immovable property in Kashmir, and who can get settlement and who can occupy the jobs in Kashmir. So by removing and by abrogation of the Article 370, 35A naturally was also, nullified. And after that, the first, step that took place, it was in May 2020, before this new law of land law, before this amendment of the law, in Kashmir, the event that took place was about the domicile law. Based on the domicile law, actually, they started to redefine who could be possibly resident of Kashmir.
Okay.
And you know that under the great pressure of the central government, almost 12.5 lakhs of the domicile certificates were issued for non-Kashmiris, for those who were already in Kashmir, but they were not Kashmiris.
Okay, stay with me. Stay with me, Saibaz Ruhollah. Stay with me. Let me get Reza back on this discussion. Now, some experts have compared Indian tactics to Israeli tactics against Palestinians and point to the close relationship now between New Delhi and Tel Aviv. Your take on that side of things?
I think when we talk about settler colonialism and the idea of a settler colonial project, as I mentioned earlier, it is very much in line with the Zionist project that is going on in occupied Palestine. And the links, as you mentioned, are things that have become very strong in recent years. And it is something that we can see that some of the ideas that are being used within Indian occupied Kashmir are similar to the projects that the Israelis have enacted within occupied Palestine in terms of land grabs, in terms of reassignment of land, in terms of taking all those things. So what we're seeing is very much, in that line, in that kind of dynamics of legitimizing or trying to legitimize that what they're actually doing is very much part and parcel of what this whole thing is actually about. And as Saibaz Ruhollah actually explained very clearly, is that these laws are things that have actually been passed. And what we see within the Israeli Knesset is the same kind of things of passing these laws so that it gives it a framework of legality, legitimacy, etc., etc., which it basically neither of those things possess, because ultimately it is about colonization of land, it's occupation of a land. And what it ultimately leads to is that the discussion needs to go down the route of how this is going to be resisted, how it's going to be resisted by people on the ground, how it is going to be resisted and supported by people from outside of that area, in terms of making sure that those people are able to get their legitimate rights and so on. So those links that you're talking about are very much in the offing, and I think they have become strong, and I think they're going to become stronger. And I think what we need to think about is that all of those things are going to be start to be enacted over a period of time, regardless of what the government in India will actually be saying. And the resistance to those kind of laws being normalized within occupied Kashmir, there needs to be a resistance that also matches and takes into account that this is something that is very much in the offing, and this is how things are going to develop in that area. So I think it's very clear the direction in which these things are going to go.
Well, Sarbaz Ruhollah, you heard Reza basically saying about how this is going to be resisted. Your take on that side of things, how do you think the people of Kashmir are going to continue to resist this type of pressure coming out of New Delhi?
You know, we have, as my dear brother Reza mentioned, we have this clear history of Palestine in front of us, and every and each person in Kashmir is aware about what's going to take place, and not only Kashmiri people. Everyone in the world knows what is going to be the next step of India, because the history of Palestine is in front of us. It started with land grabbing, it started with so-called selling and purchasing the lands of Palestinians, but history knows better than everyone that not more than 1% of the occupied lands of Palestine were those lands sold to the Jews. Now, the same thing is going to take no one in Kashmir, no Kashmiri is going to sell any land to anyone from outside. Let me make it very clear, even not to Muslims of India. Kashmiris are not going to sell India lands to the Muslims of India, because it's not a religious matter, it's a political matter. By a sense, Kashmir issue is a political issue. We don't believe that it's an, you know, religious issue. It's not an issue related to Islam and Hinduism. That's what, you know, BJP want to portray. So Kashmiris are not going to sell their lands. But as what we observed in occupied lands of Palestine, it's not a matter of purchasing the lands. It is, it's actually providing an opportunity, providing an environment for Indians to start making, colonies. We know, and I know, and everyone else in Kashmir, any Kashmiri knows that the next step will be bringing, pandits, bringing those Hindus of Kashmir. Any Kashmiri is welcoming the Hindus of Kashmir. Pandits of Kashmir are most welcome. They are from Kashmir. They have been from Kashmir, and everyone in Kashmir is, you know, welcoming them back to their homeland, Kashmir. But now we are observing another colonial policy of Indians. They want to make colonies inside inside Kashmir, and actually those colonies will be the start point of the clashes in Kashmir. They will make, they could, this move could make the condition of the Kashmir much more worse than the current situation. That's what we have to observe. I mean, after the domicile law, now this new law, which is actually just removal of one sentence, there is no need to, if you want to purchase any land in Kashmir, there is no need to be the permanent resident of Kashmir. Because before this, based on the law that was, based according to 35A, Article 35A of the Indian Constitution, anyone who wants to buy any piece of land in Kashmir, he should be permanent resident of Kashmir.
Okay.
So now this has been removed. So
right.
Anyone, any company, any other party from India can come to Kashmir and start purchasing the lands.
All right.
Well,
Reza, let me get Reza back in on this. Reza, do you think that the international community should get involved in this issue in order to try to resolve it? Or what do you see as being the key to trying to resolve this situation?
I think ultimately what you need to ask is the people of Kashmir what they actually want. And this is something that is fundamentally enshrined. And I think that means that there should be no interference from Delhi. There should be no interference from anyone else, and actually try and get that resolved in that kind of a way where the people of Kashmir have the right to determine their future and the right to decide what they're going to do in the future. And I think it's something that is fundamental in terms of how things are going to be move forward. I think any other option in terms of trying to divide up or carve up Kashmir is unacceptable to the people of Kashmir, and I think that's something that needs to be kept fundamentally very much in the minds of people. And we also need to think about that when we have interference. It needs to be kept, you know, the idea that somehow the people who created this mess and the powers that continue to create these messes, for example, the US, for example, you know, this is another colonial mess that is down to Britain, down to the UK, that has been created and has been left in this way. And those kind of people and those countries cannot be involved in that process, because the solutions are not going to come from there. It's not going to be happening from there. So I think it needs to be something that is more regional, that needs to determine where things are actually going to go. And in terms of actually making those final decisions, it has to be down to the people of Kashmir as to where they will go and how they will determine their future and how they will figure out their political governance.
Well, Sarwar Ruhollah, why doesn't the United Nations implement the UNSC Resolution 47, which states that India should hold a plebiscite and allow the Kashmiris to decide for themselves, as Reza was just talking about, if they want to be a part of Pakistan or India or independent?
Yeah, frankly speaking, the first problem that the United Nations has not, you know, discussed this issue of Kashmir. You know, there is no enforcement for what they have decided. This is the first problem. The second problem is with the both sides. Let's be very frank. United Nations in its resolutions have clearly mentioned that both India and Pakistan have taken their troops back, which is demilitarized. And United Nations has given just right to India to keep a minimum level of the number of the forces there to make the environment ready for the plebiscite. But nor India, neither Pakistan did not follow what United Nations asked them. And it actually messed up with the conditions, you know, after that, and nothing was changed, actually. And day by day, the situation of Kashmir became worse. The reality is that the Kashmir issue and the problem between India and Pakistan and Kashmir is not important for both, unfortunately. Let's be very frank. Even and the Muslim, countries, even the Muslim Ummah, is not paying as it should pay attention to what's going on in Kashmir. Now we are at the edge of a new Palestine. Everything is ready for a creation of the new mess, new Palestine. Of course, Kashmir is there under pressure all these 7 decades. But now their demography is under threat. And here by demography, even again, I want to make it very clear that we don't take it from the religious aspect to Hindu-Muslim issue. No. Let's be very frank towards this. The issue is about the new demographical change based on the colonial, agendas of India. They want to change Kashmir, and you should know that there is, of course, from the hardliners, from Hindu hardliners, from Hindu RSS groups inside India, that those sorts of agendas against Kashmir, because they were believing that Kashmir is a holy land for Hindus, and it should return back again to Hindus, and these stuffs is going on. This narration is also another part of the problem. We need Muslim countries, specifically those countries whom we can expect. Iran, Turkey, Malaysia, Indonesia, in collaboration with Pakistan, they should get together and they should put pressure on India. India has to accept Kashmir issue is an international issue. Also Pakistan, it's not a bilateral issue between Pakistan and India to resolve in between. It's what Pakistan has unfortunately accepted in 1972, the Chinda Agreement, where they accepted that Kashmir is an issue between India and Pakistan, which is not. Kashmir is an international issue. There are United Nations resolutions about Kashmir passed. Everyone and every just human being will confess that Kashmiri people have the right of determination, and to decide about their future. And that should take place. India should accept it. We are living in 21st century. Things cannot be like this. They cannot suppress the people. 10 million people cannot be on the blockade. You cannot, cut your relation with the rest of the world for 6 months. This is unacceptable, specific for a country like India, which is claiming to be a democratic country, which is claiming to be a secular country.
Okay.
That's quite unacceptable.
All right. Well, Reza, what do you think is key to actually bringing this situation, basically calming it down, or the Kashmiris getting what they want? What's key here? What has to happen?
I think there needs to be a fundamental change within the governance within India. I think that is, what we're seeing is part of what's actually going on right across India. This Hindu government, Hindu supremacist government that has actually come into power, is going to be damaging for all sections of Indian society, whether it's in Kashmir or in India or whatever. You know, it's something that's going to be problematic right the way across. And I think one of the things that must happen is that what has been neglected by people in India is this basic issue of Kashmir. And what happens whenever you leave, you let an injustice to fester, that injustice then ultimately spreads and it starts to impact on other people. And people need to recognize they need to start resisting together against this Hindu supremacy, because this is going to target all sections of Indian society.
Okay.
Right across India.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us on the discussion about the situation in Kashmir. Out of London, from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Reza Kazem, and out of Qom, Iran, peace and justice activist and researcher, Sarbaz Ruhollah Rasvi. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Trump campaign and Nevada Republicans have asked a state court to stop Nevada from counting its mail-in ballots in the diverse Las Vegas Clark County jurisdiction. With no credible legal basis, the Nevada lawsuit is among the many clear signs that Trump and the Republicans are committed to relentlessly sabotaging the popular vote, says Harvey Wasserman Ryder in an article published under the heading Trump's Attacks on Mail-in Voting in Las Vegas Could End Up at the Supreme Court. Stay tuned for the details, please. The Trump campaign and Nevada Republicans have asked the state court to stop Nevada from counting its mail-in ballots in the diverse Las Vegas Clark County jurisdiction. The suit joins a wide range of GOP attempts to shut down the counting of such votes in swing states like Nevada, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Florida. The Republicans' pretext seems to be over how the ballots are scrutinized. But the real reason could lie in the fact that Clark is the state's most diverse county, with more than 31% Latino citizens, 13% Black, and about 10% Asian American. As Trump well knows, citizens of color tend to vote in ways he does not like. With no credible legal basis, the Nevada lawsuit is among the many clear signs that Trump and the Republicans are committed to relentlessly sabotaging the popular vote. With another extreme Trumpist just joining the Supreme Court, there is little doubt the Trump campaign intends to move this and other lawsuits in Nevada and elsewhere as far as they can, hoping to delay the vote counting in swing states to the safer harbor of its right-wing Supreme Court majority. If SCAPS eventually approves one or more such assaults on voting by mail and succeeds in hopelessly complicating the requirements for counting mail-in ballots, as Trump is trying to do in Nevada, the ultimate decision in this election could be shifted from millions of voters to the right-wing judges on the Supreme Court. In the face of the pandemic, Nevada has ordered ballots mailed to all registered voters. In the eyes of the Trump Republicans, this is the ultimate act of terror, raising the terminal specter of a functional democracy. It forms the basis for a public election that could proceed smoothly and could quickly provide a fair outcome that reflects the real intent of the general electorate. Trump has been infamously sabotaging the U.S. Postal Service, delaying many of the ballots' returns. But Nevada's ballots were mailed out weeks ago. Trump has also injected chaos into the process, screaming at every turn that the election is fraudulent. GOP attacks have focused strongly on deadlines for acceptance of mail-in ballots, working to discard even those postmarked on or even prior to November 3rd, but which arrive late. Court decisions on these and other issues have become a toxic morass of contradictory rulings, with acceptable procedures varying widely from state to state, all awaiting final rulings from a heavily politicized scouts. As elsewhere, the universal ballot mailing has been strongly endorsed by Nevada's duly elected governor, by its legislature, the first in U.S. history with a majority of women, and by its Secretary of State. Such procedures have been a standard practice in Colorado, Utah, Oregon, Washington, and Hawaii for many years. When the bill passed by the Nevada legislature and was signed by its governor in early August, Trump sued. Nevada's Republican Secretary of State, Barbara Kegosby, moved to dismiss, arguing that, absent a concrete and particularized injury to plaintiffs, the court has no jurisdiction to intervene in election preparations because plaintiffs have failed to plead facts from which one might reasonably infer that an injury is actual and imminent, not hypothetical. The court should dismiss their claims for lack of jurisdiction. As per its legislation, the state has already begun counting ballots. As they are coming in almost entirely on paper, they will be counted almost entirely on digital scanners, which can produce an extremely accurate and rapid vote count. Trump has trailed consistently in Nevada's public opinion polls. With a fair vote count, he is widely expected to lose a state carried by Hillary Clinton in 2016 by about 2.5%. But now that he has added another right-wing extremist to the Supreme Court, Trump is certain to use this suit as a vehicle to undermine the Nevada election and with it, the nation as a whole. Any legal basis on which Trump might claim fraud or personal injury from Nevada's relatively smooth conduct of this year's election would be pure partisan fantasy. Solidly supported by his top officials, any Supreme Court attack on the conduct of Nevada's election would have to derive from a full frontal attack on vote by mail itself, one that could resonate throughout the swing states that are likely to decide the election. That Trump himself votes by mail would be deemed as being of no consequence. The six right-wingers who now dominate the court might choose to use this procedural challenge as a pretext by which the idea of mailing ballots to registered voters and counting them quickly and efficiently could be found to be somehow unworkable. In other words, the court would undermine virtually the entire basis of this year's voting. There would be just one clear beneficiary, Donald Trump. It would be the clearest, most egregious partisan judicial attack on democracy since the founding of the Republic. But given the personnel now on the court, it's an entirely possible outcome. Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett have all been appointed by Trump. Along with Kavanaugh and Barrett, John Roberts was an active partisan in the infamous Bush and Gore decision trashing the popular will in the 2000 election that enthroned George W. Bush despite his having lost the public vote. Clarence Thomas voted in favor of that decision from the bench. Hard righty Samuel Alito can be expected to join any decision meant to further the dictatorial powers of Donald Trump. The scouts' trashing of the line extensions in the various states did get a competence in the case of Vermont when Brett Kavanaugh was forced to correct an erroneous characterization of the state's rules and procedures. But its assault on equitable distribution of drop boxes, ID and witness requirements, the demand that ex-felons pay fines before being allowed to vote, and other selective limitation of the franchise has been unrelenting. Like Trump himself, the six scouts' rightists appear to have no moral or ethical qualms about undermining the will of the American public in an election based on democratic principles and practices. How the public would react to the official sabotage of this year's election with no real legal basis remains to be seen. If the court conjures some pretext to destroy Nevada's and other swing states' vote-by-mail systems by stopping the ballot counting and disqualifying ballots that arrive late, it will be 2000 all over again. It will replay George W. Bush versus Al Gore, with which the scouts' majority and a disenfranchised American public is so familiar. Doing that could render the 2020 election a smoldering ruin. The question would then become, how would the public react to the dictatorial destruction of the last vestiges of U.S. democracy?
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.